Sonia Van Meter is on the phone right now. Hey, Sonia, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being up so late. Did you stay up? Did you take a nap? What did you do?
I cannot reveal my secret. It's a trade secret.
She's hammered. She's been up drinking. Okay. Her Twitter handle is Bourbon Face. If that tells you anything, our good friend Sonia Van Meter, who we haven't talked to. Sonia, we haven't talked to you in forever. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know what? For a Democrat living in the Trump era, I feel like Bourbon Face is the only appropriate handle to have.
A Democrat living in the Trump era who lives in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But you do live, you are in Austin at least, right?
I am. I'm in the very best of Texas.
Austin is like the green zone, like Iraq. There's places you can be and survive. For a Democrat, you have to live in Austin if you live in Texas, I think is the rule, right?
Well, Austin and Houston and Dallas are starting to show signs of resistance life. Mm-hmm. Hillary made some interesting gains in the areas around Houston and Dallas in this last election that we were not expecting, especially given that she didn't spend a lot of money here. So, yeah, signs of life.
Okay. All right. So in a little while, not right now, because I do want to talk to you, because we always talk about space, because I first met you because there were stories about you as possibly being one of the first Martians. And are you outside? Are you actually outside right now?
I am, man. It's a beautiful night.
You're like, for a walk in the neighborhood, you know? It's 3 a.m. It's all right. All right. So
as one does.
We'll come back to the space stuff in a little bit. But I've never really talked to you about your real life that much. So for a job, you are an oppo researcher, right? You do opposition research for candidates?
I do. That is exactly what I do.
So does that mean that I'm running for office and you're doing research on me for what everybody might dig up on me, or you're working for me, and then whoever my opponent is, you're trying to do the digging up? Which is it, or is it both?
I do both, actually. We call it self research when we're doing research on our own clients,
okay.
The people that we're working for, and then it's opposition research, obviously, when we're working on your opponent. But it's all the same process.
Is one more important than the other? Is it more important to know what could come out against yourself, or more important to know what you can use to your advantage over your opponent?
They're both important, but I don't really like working for candidates who aren't interested in doing the deep dive on themselves, because no matter what you hurl at other people, if you're not prepared for what's coming at you, what is that line? The best offense is a strong defense, or the best defense is a strong offense. It's sort of along those lines. If you don't know yourself, if you don't know your vulnerabilities, you're going to be easily sunk in a campaign. So
it's interesting. So you said, I don't like working for a candidate who doesn't want to do the research on themselves. Do you find mm-hmm. that the candidates who don't want to do the research on themselves probably have something pretty big to hide?
It's not that they have something to hide. It's that they feel like they know themselves. You know, that's a perfectly legitimate experience. You know, we all think that we know what we have done in our life. The problem is that our memories are fallible. We have a way of sort of glorifying the things that we like about ourselves while sort of diminishing the things that we aren't especially proud of.
Interesting.
But it's also a question of third-party perspective. I mean, like, it is one thing to know yourself. It is entirely another to see all the material that is available on you and figure out how someone who doesn't know you is going to interpret it. So
yeah.
That's why you hire me.
Yeah, I wonder, when you're finding research on when you're doing the self-research, are you finding that there's things that they're like, wait a minute, I forgot that, or I didn't remember that, or it's more, yeah, I know that, but that's not a big deal. And you're like, well, in other people's hands, it's going to be a much bigger deal than you think.
Matt, I've had to tell people about live arrest warrants for them.
That they didn't know were out there, or they didn't think you'd find out about?
That they didn't know were out there. They had no idea.
Wow, that's...
It's amazing. It's amazing some of the things that you will find. Yeah.
That must be an interesting meeting. Mr. Future Mayor, here's the thing. They're looking to arrest you, so you really got to clear that up before we move it forward with this. Live arrest warrants. That's mm-hmm. That had to have caught them by surprise, I would think.
A little bit. And it's usually something silly, like you forgot to pay a speeding ticket that you got in a county, you know, six counties away from you that you just happened to be passing through one day. And these are the kind of things. This is why you hire an opposition researcher, because you never know what's going to come up.
I imagine. Now, I don't expect you to reveal any names or anything like that, or tell anything that, you know, I'm sure there's a bit of a doctor-patient confidentiality here, right? But
always.
Have you ever done the research, come to the candidate and said, okay, here's what we found? And they said, okay, well, didn't expect that, and now I have to drop out. I mean, do you ever go to somebody and say, there's no way you're going to win when we found out this about you?
Actually, Actually, yes. And it's happened both ways. We've had people, we've done the self-research on them, and it wasn't necessarily what we found. It's that they didn't realize just how much there was going to be and didn't want to put sort of their family through it. Yeah, that kind of thing. We've also done research on opponents, dropped just a little bit of that information to like a reporter, and they've dropped out.
Because they think, okay, if they found out that there's a lot more that there could be, probably?
Sometimes it's that. Sometimes they just realize, oh, wait, this is going to be something that I don't necessarily want other people knowing about me, and they just sort of politely bow out. Sorry, I get it. You take this. It's fine. I'll just exit quietly.
You know what's interesting, Sonia, is I like you a lot. I think you're a really nice person, and I've loved talking to you over the years. You could see where, and you're like, okay, here comes the butt. You could see where, as we're having this conversation, there would be people thinking, and I'm wondering if we should be thinking, work like this is the problem with politics, right? Because we're looking into, now this is where you look into the opponent and see what they have going on in their personal life, and that's why they have to get out, or they end up being kind of run out of politics. And maybe they're a good person who's made mistakes or whatever. Do you ever worry about, you know, because we worry and we've talked about it. We don't talk about it right now because things have gone so off the rails that this is like small potatoes, I think, and it's we're so past that. But let's go to a quaint era like 30 years ago where you know, let's go back to what's his name and his monkey ship with the woman he dared the press to find. Who was that? Gary Hart? Like a time like that where then people would say, oh, this is the politics of destruction or this and that, where we're just looking to smear people. And that's why nobody good goes into this anymore. Do you think about that at all? Or do you think is that irrelevant? Because, listen, if you're hiding something, you're hiding something, and it's a politician, they're here to represent us, we should know as much as we can about them.
So I hear you completely. And certainly in this era of Donald Trump, when, you know, everything makes for great clickbait, there seems to be more and more of what people call opposition research in the media. But here's the thing about what I do. I am only interested in publicly available records. I am not going through your trash. I am not taking pictures through your windows at night. I am not outing your gay child. The stuff that I am looking at, society already agrees, should be a matter of public record. Things like your criminal history, civil court cases. You know, do you have liens with the IRS? And the reason that these things we all agree are publicly available is because these are things that indicate character and also what your habits will be like once you're in office. I'm not especially interested in the fact that Donald Trump has, you know, half a dozen children with three different women, all of whom he cheated on. I am interested in who is the Supreme Court nominee he's going to push. These are things that are relevant to voters. And opposition research is about the stuff that is going to be relevant to the voters. We're not so much interested in the sleazy stuff and the slimy stuff. We are interested in the patterns, though. And demonstrating the patterns is a huge part of how opposition researchers help society decide who to vote for. You know, are you looking for a fiscal conservative or a social conservative? How does this person vote on these issues? What has this person said about these issues? It's not necessarily about destroying the candidate. It's about helping voters understand who they are better. We like to consider ourselves, you know, the people holding politicians accountable. And now if it happens that you have done something, you know, exorbitantly shady or immoral in your life, yes, I would like to be able to find that and demonstrate it to the public so that they know who they're voting for when they cast a vote for you. But at the end of the day, it's about drawing comparisons. It's not necessarily about destroying careers.
So is your job much easier when it's been somebody who's been around for a long time, who's, you know, as we've seen with the presidential candidates over recent years, when somebody has been in the Senate a long time, had to vote on a lot of different things. Now there's a lot of different things to say, well, he voted on this, and so you can use that or things like that, versus somebody who's brand new to politics who doesn't have a big voting record. That must make your job tougher, I would think.
Well, it depends, to be quite honest. I mean, obviously, if you've got somebody like Bob Dole or Strom Thurmond, who's been in office for 150 years, there's plenty of material to draw from. But somebody like Donald Trump, who has never spent, you know, before he ran for president, hadn't ever been a public figure, at least in public office, there was plenty of material on him, you know? Now, obviously, he's not someone that you want to necessarily model your plans after. But, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, public figures when they decide they want to go into office. you know, sometimes their experience isn't necessarily in politics, but in business, or in the nonprofit world, or, you know, they're a lawyer and they have a huge legal history or a law firm that they've been with for a long time. It depends on the candidate. Not everyone has a huge political history, but that doesn't mean that, you know, especially with the advent of social media, you know, there's yeah. usually something to find on people these days.
Do you, so since we're talking about Trump right now, with what happened there, he didn't have a big voting record, but he's been a public figure forever. He's talked about politics, tweeted about politics nonstop for the last 5 or 6 years. So there was a lot there. But no matter what he did, he still won. And it's amazing yep. that no matter what he said, and he himself said, I could shoot somebody, people would still vote for me. And he was, it seems right. Because no matter what he did, he still won the election. So when you look back at that now, this many months later, did Trump win the election or did Hillary lose the election?
It's a little bit of both. And you know, full disclosure, I'm a huge Hillary supporter.
Sure.
But she has admitted, you know, mistakes were made. But one thing that I kind of like to remind people, we're at some 90,000 votes across, you know, a handful of counties in three states all told, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, it electorally, it was a big margin because of the way the Electoral College is set up and the way that votes are counted from each state. But numerically, she won the popular vote. You know, like more Americans wanted her than Donald Trump.
Right.
So, you know, there were some logistical problems in terms of where she decided to do a lot of her messaging, you know, where her voter, her get out the vote operation was strongest. A lot of her get out the votes effort was concentrated on registering new voters as opposed to communicating with existing voters. In short, you know, she had some bad models. She was working with some bad models. And then also, Donald Trump was the most non-traditional candidate we had ever seen.
Sure.
She was treated in the media as a serious candidate. Her record was scrutinized. She was, you know, they called the balls and strikes on her time in the U.S. Senate and her time as Secretary of State. Donald Trump was treated as a sideshow act. You know, the media couldn't get enough of him. And this, I do not blame the media. I mean, he was a bright, shining meteor across the sky. I mean, every time he opened up his mouth, he was saying something so outrageous and so ridiculous that, of course, the media was going to cover everything he said, and not especially cover, you know, whether or not he was well equipped for this job.
Right.
And again, cannot say this enough. I don't necessarily blame the media. He was an attraction. You know, he was crazy. He was interesting.
And I do think we overcovered him like crazy. And we talked about this here before. I was filling in one night. When he came back from Mexico, that day he came back from Mexico, he was holding a press conference that night, I think, in Arizona about the wall and mm-hmm. stuff. And we carried it live. And we debated here, if Hillary was giving the speech, we wouldn't carry it live. So why are we carrying this live? And we ended up saying, because we don't know what he's going to say, and it is newsworthy, mm-hmm. and this is different. So we carried it. So I do agree with that. But I also think that the media also beat the hell out of him a lot on the lawsuits and everything. I mean, those tapes come out, so much stuff. Negative also came out there. I felt like for the first 8 months of the campaign, he got all the free everything. And the last couple months leading up to the election, it seems like every other story was a negative story that was coming out about him. So there was a lot of that, too.
For sure. But here was the difference. Donald Trump has absolutely no shame. When you expose unpleasant and difficult stories about other politicians, they have the good sense to show just the slightest bit of remorse. This guy basically extended a gigantic middle finger to America and said, I do what I want. And for some reason, that resonated with a lot of voters because it comes across as power and strength and authority. And that is not something that wasn't Hillary's strong suit. Those were not characteristics that she was playing to.
And that, quite frankly, a woman maybe wouldn't get away with like a man did yet. I think we're still not there yet, right?
Yeah, certainly not. And after 8 years of Obama, with his incredibly measured and reasoned rhetoric, always trying to be the brainiac in the room, the guy who gets everyone's input before he makes a decision, you know, I think, you know, middle America was kind of ready for a guy with some balls, you know? So in hindsight, I mean, it's really easy to say this in hindsight, 2020, of course. It's easy to understand, you know, where Donald Trump came from and how he was able to pull this off. But, you know, it's hard to see it when it's happened in 2 years.
Yeah. And it actually worked for him. So there's that. And how has that changed candidates since then, candidates you've worked with since he won? Now, I know you're working probably exclusively with Democrats, so maybe it's not changed things for them. But I wonder, though, if people aren't saying, you say, well, you know, if this happens, you're going to be smart enough to apologize or say this, and they're going to be like, but Trump said, oh, it's just locker room talk and moved on. Why are we going to apologize? Bill Maher has kind of been on this bandwagon, right, with the Democrats saying, let's not take Michelle's advice and go high when they go low. Let's go low too, because here's what, man, and like you said, oh, it was only 90,000 votes. But here's the problem with her losing just 90,000 votes and having 3 million more. They don't have any power for 4 years. And all the craziness that Democrats hate is in control right now in Washington. So as great as maybe it was, and that the Americans really wanted her, and it's only 90,000 votes over these counties, it's 4 years, so that sucks. So do the Democrats need to be a little less, we'll go high when they go low?
Well, there's certainly a little bit of that. I mean, the Democrats are, of course, reassessing, you know, their sort of message. But I think you also have to remember that Donald Trump's approval ratings are in the toilet. And his numbers aren't just falling with Democrats and independents. So every time he loses a week of his presidency to scandal or to some stupid story or some tweet, he is not pushing his agenda. He's not advancing his agenda. He's not getting that wall built. He's not getting health care passed. It's taken him this long to get his Muslim ban in place, and it's only partially in place, and the courts still have to hear it. He has been a remarkably ineffective president. He's got you know, hundreds of seats that are still vacant in his administration, just because he hasn't gotten around to appointing them and getting them nominated and getting them approved. A certain candidate can get away with being a little more, maybe even vulgar, certainly a little more aggressive. But at the end of the day, this guy is proving to be kind of silly as a president in terms of, you know, getting his agenda pushed through. And that's not going to play well with his own voters. As the dominoes start to fall on this Russia investigation, on these, allegations about collusion, I don't see things going especially well for him. So as far as I'm concerned, what Democrats need to do in 18 is figure out their message, and then keep in mind that you can't just talk to big urban areas. You've got to talk to all the voters. You've got to talk to the ones in the rural areas who feel like they haven't heard a Democrat speak to them in 20 years. You've got to talk to, you know, suburban people candidates assume that, you know, they're going to have these people because they're a certain demographic. We just got to remember to talk to people. And I think 18 is going to be a good time for Democrats.
Well, you say, well, that's not going to play well with his voters. And Sonia, I feel like we can't say that. We don't know. He's going to, because what's going to happen is you're saying, well, he didn't get all these things done. He promised the voters. He's going to say, because of the media, because of the Democrats. I mean, he spins everything. He's very good at always making it seem like he won.
He doesn't need a single Democratic vote. He does not need a single Democratic vote.
Yeah.
In the House. He absolutely does not. Like, him trying to blame this on Democrats.
Yeah,
absolutely,
that's wonderful.
And I'm going to help. I'm going to help people remember that. You know, he can run on that, sure, but his Republican Party, the GOP, congressional Republicans, can't run on that.
Well,
Democratic obstruction, no.
That's the thing. The 2018 elections really will tell. Can Democrats actually make a dent? Can Democrats get some control back? Sonia, we need to take a quick break in the news. Can we chat a little bit more about politics and also get an update on Mars?
Absolutely.
All right. Hold on 1 second. We'll be right back. Sonia Von Meter is a Democratic opposition researcher. She does politics. She also aspires to be one of the first people living on Mars. Probably aspires more than ever at this point in life, I would imagine, with how crazy things are right now. But we'll find out more about that. And President Trump actually made a big speech about space on Friday, and we're going to play a little bit of that for you when we come back from the news, which is next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. We're speaking with Sonja von Meter at Bourbon Face on Twitter. She's a Democratic opposition researcher. Do I say that right? Is it a Democratic opposition researcher or just an oppo researcher?
No, I think it's fair to say I'm a Democrat.
Okay. I just didn't know. You know, the check's clear from both sides, but do you ever work for Republicans, or are you just, you know, your politics are so to the one side that you just don't even bother working if they wanted to hire you? Because who better to hire if I was Republican? I wanted to make sure, you know, that people, you know, that I knew what was going to get found out. I'd want to hire somebody who really didn't want me in office, maybe to do the digging.
You know what? We have worked for Republicans in the past, but only in Republican primaries. We don't work for Republicans running against Democrats. But, you know, any Democrat, and, you know, we work nonpartisan races. Lord knows there's nonpartisan races all over the country. So, you know, it just depends on the client.
Do you work it all over the country, or is it mostly in Texas?
Oh, it's definitely all over the country. There's like 9 Democrats in Texas, man. I die of hunger.
I hadn't really thought that through, I guess. Good point. Good point. Okay, so so let's jump back onto the bandwagon here a little bit about the politics. And you mentioned that, you know, what they have to do going into 2018. How are things looking right now? What do you think the Democrats are headed in the right direction? Do you think they're finding the right people? I know that there's a lot of buzz and there's a lot of heat going on, you know, as Donald Trump keeps having trouble avoiding scandal. But I think that, again, it's his people aren't feeling it the way everybody else is. Although with his approval ratings being so low, you have to imagine that some of the people who voted for him aren't very happy. So there has to be some of that. Do you think Democrats right now are headed in the right direction?
You know, I think we are. I think it's still a little early. You know, we've only had, you know, what, 4 special elections since November, and the Republicans have taken them all. But there are some indicators that momentum is going to swing toward the Democrats. You know, look at what happened in Kansas and in Georgia in these special elections. The seats that had been won in November by, you know, double-digit margins are suddenly coming down to, you know, to just a few points. And the Republicans are having to spend millions and millions of dollars to defend these seats. You know, John Ossoff in Georgia, you know, mind you, it was the most expensive congressional race in history. But Price took that seat easily in November. And when Karen Handel took it, she had to spend, you know, $25 million to keep it. When 18 rolls around, they're not, the Republican Party isn't going to have millions and millions of dollars to spend on, you know, over 400 congressional seats. So I think things are definitely trending our way. That being said, Democrats need to hone their message, and they need to find the right candidates. You know, there was a lot of question about whether or not John Ossoff was the right candidate for that seat. So we've got some work to do.
Do the Democrats have the millions and millions of dollars they will need to fight for those seats?
Democratic fundraising is going very, very well right now across the country. We're seeing a lot of enthusiasm. It's not just the grassroots. People are donating. They're donating to causes. You know, one good headline means thousands of dollars for any particular candidate. Because of the way that social media works, and because, you know, we live in the 24-hour news cycle, you get one good quote, you know, or bad quote, and all of a sudden your opponent is raking on the dollars because everybody either hates you or loves you. There's a lot of opportunity here if Democrats can capitalize on it.
What is your feeling on the people that were so upset about Bernie Sanders not getting the nomination that they didn't vote for Hillary, whether they voted for Trump or just didn't vote?
I think there's a lot of that. I think that I'm not sure it made the difference. It may or may not have. We're going to be looking at this kind of information, you know, this kind of data for the next several years, trying to figure out exactly what happened. But I think that lodging a protest vote for Trump or protesting by not showing up or voting for a third party, we're having to live with the repercussions of this now. And I know so many people who voted for Trump as a protest vote, because everyone said, oh, no, Hillary's got this. It's in the bag. You know, there's never been a safer time to lodge a protest vote. You know, and now we're living with the ramifications of that vote. And, you know, people aren't happy. People aren't happy with what they're seeing. You know, the independents and the Democrats certainly aren't. And you know, more moderate Republicans who maybe stayed home or voted for Trump thinking, you know, it's fine, I can be loyal to my party and it won't make a difference, are having to come to terms with, you know, with the fact that our president is a mockery of leadership. So there's a lot going on, and you know, Democrats have a lot of work to do, certainly.
Yeah.
But I think things are, I think there's a lot of room for growth. So I think that the people who, you know, launched these third party protest votes are going to come around. I think they will see the error of their ways.
Okay. So we, Roger and I, like to do this here once in a while. We talk about our predictions on the Trump presidency. My prediction is that he will not run for re-election because he will have accomplished his goals. America will be great again. Of course, this would be how he would spin it, right? He would say he did all these great things despite the historic this that I faced and the witch hunt and da 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 da. But my guess is that being a president is a kind of an annoying job. And when you're used to running a company and whatever you say is what people do, it's got to be very tough to suddenly take a job where you don't get to do that. Whatever you say doesn't necessarily happen. You've got to fight through all this stuff. And just at his age, and I think it's going to wear him out and be like, God, why do I want to do this for another 4 years? I think he'll drop out victorious, of course, and as one of the greatest presidents ever and everything that'll tell us. But I don't see the investigations getting anywhere that we actually get to the level of impeachment. And I don't see him running for a second term because I think it's just too annoying to him to have to go through all this. Where do you think things end? Where do you think we're at 4 years from now?
I think you're absolutely right that he has no interest in running for re-election. For him, it was about winning. It wasn't about being the president. It was about winning the presidency. He is not having any fun. You know, he's putting on weight. He's miserable, according to all of his aides. You know, this isn't the life that he wanted. He wanted to win because it was an ego boost, because it was a validation. And now he's done that. I think you're absolutely right. If he manages to survive this presidency, I don't think he runs for re-election. On the other hand, I've been wrong about him before. Maybe he decides that he wants to run because it would be more validation. And come his next term, he doesn't have to care as much. He just appoints people to make those decisions, and he lets, you know, his vice president basically won the show.
Yeah.
I don't know. On the other hand, here's what I do know. This Russia investigation isn't going anywhere. And it is my hypothesis that there is, in fact, fire where we're seeing all this smoke. If we are able to make enough inroads in the 2018 elections, I certainly don't think we'll bring impeachment before the midterm. But I think come 2019, we could be looking at a very, very different climate in this country. And I think the American people might start demanding some action on this. But we'll see, you know. I've been wrong about this before.
Sure. Speaking purely politically, do you think it's in the Democrats' interest to have him impeached? Because then you put Pence in office and give him a couple of years to possibly build some equity in the office and then run into, you know, I don't think you, if Trump's not going to run again, I don't think you want to give Pence a bunch of time of being president first, necessarily.
I don't think Pence survives that. I think that this goes a little deeper than most people imagine. I think that if and when Trump goes down, it won't just be him. It'll be him. It'll be, you know, a huge number of people in his cabinet. It'll be, you know, senior leadership in Congress. I mean, there's a, now that these dominoes are falling, I think we're ultimately going to see that it was not just Donald Trump. This is not just one man. Obstruction, you know, involves a lot of players. And I think at the end of the day, we won't have a President Pence. We'll have like a President Orrin Hatch by the time all
the
dust.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's, you know, we're still a long way away from that, you know, but these investigations aren't going anywhere. And I think that this is much bigger than most people realize.
Okay. I'm going to bet that, unfortunately, that you're wrong, that this goes nowhere, that they're going to have stuff on them, but it's not going to get anywhere.
The last time I made a bet on your show, I lost so abysmally. It's a miracle you ever wanted to have me back.
That's right. What was our bet? And you never paid up, by the way. What was our bet?
I I forget. I just know
was
that
it
I
just
lost
Hillary winning, or was it something different?
No, it was Hillary winning a certain number of states, and I could not have been more wrong.
All right. Well, I won't hold your feet to the fire in this one, but you know what? We have a little audio for you. Your favorite current president, Donald Trump, spoke about space today, another favorite subject of yours. Jessica, can we hear a little bit of that? Go ahead, please.
Today, we're taking a crucial step to secure America's future in space by reviving the National Space Council after it has been dormant almost 25 years, if you can believe it. During the campaign, Vice President Pence promised that our administration, because Mike's very much into space, would revive the National Space Council. And with this executive order, we're keeping that promise. Feel very strongly about it. I felt strongly about it for a long time. I used to say, before doing what I did, I used to say, what happened? Why aren't we moving forward? Today's announcement sends a clear signal to the world that we are restoring America's proud legacy of leadership in space. Our vice president cares very deeply about space policy, and for good reason. Space exploration is not only essential to our character as a nation, but also our economy and our great nation's security. Our travels beyond the Earth propel scientific discoveries that improve our lives in countless ways here, right here at home, powering vast new industries, spurring incredible technology, and providing the space security we need to protect the American people. And security is going to be a very big factor with respect to space and space exploration. At some point in the future, we're going to look back and say, how did we do it without space?
How did we do it without space? So there are a couple of very interesting things in there. First of all, I love his Mike's very much into space. Like, he's just totally ripping on Pence. Like, all right, I got to be here because my geeky VP made a big deal about this. So Mike's very into space. And then at the end, when he's talking about space security, and we need space security to protect the American people, and we're going to look back someday and say, how did we do it without space?
I don't even know what he's talking about there.
It didn't seem like the astronauts behind him did either. They were kind of making faces like, what the hell's going on? They looked sort of like the G7 did when he was making that speech.
Yeah. The Buzz Aldrin expressions were truly magnificent. I'm pretty sure they were trending on Twitter about 10 minutes later. I couldn't tell you what in the world he was talking about. And for once, I can't even just blame it on the speechwriter. Like, I don't think he had any idea what he was trying to say either. I think it's a mockery of space leadership. It was word salad. It was word salad with the word space thrown in there about 15 times.
Yeah, it was. So what does the reigniting of the National Space Council mean? Do you have any idea? Have you looked into this at all?
I really don't, to tell you the truth. I do know that his budget is not friendly to NASA. Mm-hmm. So this seems like, sort of a, what was that thing where he cut like something like millions of dollars to like EPA funding, and then donated his first quarter pay of like $70,000 to the EPA or something like that, something along those lines. It just seems like a very, very, false, very hollow effort. And I would be astounded if anything actually came of this.
All right. So speaking of space, so the reason you and I first got to know each other was because you were in the news as being selected. It was the Mars One project. They were seeking candidates to fly to Mars when they launched their deal. They got it down to 100 people and you made the 100.
I did.
And it wasn't supposed to happen until like, when was the earliest this was going to happen? Mid-2020s?
Yeah, it's about 2025.
And of course, like anything else, this is a billion and billion dollar project, and they need the funds to try to keep it going. Where's the Mars One project standing today?
Well, I don't think it's any secret that the progress has been slowed a bit. All of the candidates are still in touch with the organization, and you know, progress is still being made. They're seeking their funding. They're moving forward with their plans. But things have been pushed back a little. As you might expect, finding billions of dollars for an endeavor of this size and this sort of significance isn't something that happens overnight. And I think they ran into some stumbling blocks early on that were, you know, expected. But we are assured by leadership that things are still underway. They're seeking alternate sources of funding at this point. They're exploring other avenues. But in the meantime, especially for someone like myself, you know, I got fish to fry on this planet. You know, I am always looking up and out, and I am grateful that private industry has taken up the mantle where NASA has sort of led the charge for the longest time. Now we've got organizations, Elon Musk and Richard Branson and the like, Jeff Bezos talking about, you know, what we're doing in space and what the next step for human exploration of space should look like. Mars One is still very much a part of all that. There have been some stumbling blocks, and sure. And in the meantime, I'm operating as though I will ultimately live and die on this planet. But that's not so bad,
No, that's not so bad. Although it's funny, Sonia, you know, you would think that you just got to find a few billionaires who are like, you know what, Mars doesn't sound so bad, and maybe they're in, and you'd think you'd get the funding more quickly now that the way that America's, you know, for half of us at least, turned in like the distress, like Mars sounded pretty good. How much, what's it going to cost us? Let's get some money together. Let's go.
I'll tell you what I tell everybody else who asked me that question. You're all welcome, but the line starts behind me. All right.
Well, if I have $1 billion to contribute, guess who's skipping ahead of you in line?
All right, fine. I suppose we can make room on the rocket for you.
But and people don't remember this, Sonia, but the crazy part about the Mars One project is there was no return ticket. If you get to go, you're going to live out your life on Mars.
That was the deal. That is the deal. It absolutely is. And they did that for a lot of reasons. Number one, it's way cheaper, not having to build all the materials that you need to launch something off of Mars. To get to escape Martian atmosphere, escape Martian gravity, and get all the way back to the Earth, mm-hmm. It's a lot cheaper to do this as a one-way trip. But also, you know, that was sort of the initial design of the mission. There are going to be other organizations that want to go and come back. I assume NASA and ESA are among those organizations, and for good reason. But this is about learning about sustainability. It's about learning about long-term effects of non-Earth atmosphere, non-Earth gravity on the human body. There are a lot of things that you can study with a one-way mission that aren't on the table for a mission that includes a return visit. So this is sort of by design. There are some concerns about this kind of plan, and I'm deeply grateful that Mars One has reached out to some of the best aerospace people in the world, some of the best scientists in the world, and gotten those people on their board. So this is a very carefully thought out and planned mission. But in the meantime, while they're putting together their funding, while they're getting all things organized, there's a lot of activity for the candidates to partake in while they're still on this planet. And Lord knows, as a political consultant here in the United States, I've got some work to do.
So. Yes, you do. It's a good time to be a political consultant, I would imagine, isn't it? Is it?
It is. One of the things I'm noticing is that Democratic candidates are sort of falling from the sky right now. Donald Trump has really galvanized my party. You know, we thought we had this in the bag, and so we took our eye off the ball a little bit. And now we're sort of looking up and realizing, oh, my God, what have we wrought on this planet? So here in Texas, where we haven't seen competitive congressional races in a lot of these districts in a long time, suddenly there are competitive primaries on the Democratic side of things. You know, people have woken up and they've realized that it's not enough just to turn out once every 4 years. You have to create the society that you want to live in. So Democrats are coming out of the woodwork. They're getting off the bench. It is a good time to be a Democratic consultant. It's also a good time to be an experienced Democratic consultant. There are a lot of, sort of enthusiasts that are getting into the game. Some of them giving better advice than others. I encourage you, if you're looking for a run, if you're looking to get involved, talk to the professionals. Talk to the people that have done this a time or two. Lord knows we don't always get it right, but we do have experience with this kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a really exciting couple of years for you, and we'll keep talking. And the one other question, because people don't remember, you kind of became famous as the Mars One person also because you agreed because you would go and live out the rest of your life, but you're married. And so that that's an interesting conundrum because he don't get to go with. He's got to stay behind. And so you both had written about that and how that would work out and why you made those decisions. So I wonder now, because if you were my wife, Sonia, and we're around the house and I knew this was on the horizon, every time you annoyed me, I'm sure I would end up saying... You know, is that thing ever going to take off or, you know, do you think it's going to I would totally tease you with that all the time. Does he like to use that on you?
No, he doesn't.
Really?
He's very
Come
supportive.
On.
Yeah, no, he's the best. He's the best.
I know he's the best. Of course he is. But you got to be annoying sometimes. All married couples get in each other's skin. And he doesn't tease you with the Mars thing? Like, can we pack it up and get going already? No. He doesn't do that.
No, you know what? I think it's a missed opportunity. I think maybe I should let him know.
Well, it's not going to be the same if you tell him what to tease you with. I'll send him an email. I'll help him out.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Sonia Van Meter, she is a Democratic opposition researcher and a wonderful person, and hopefully someday a resident of the planet Mars. We'll see if it can ever work out. But Sonia, in a few months, I'd love to chat with you again as the races start heating up and we learn more about new candidates and things like that, okay?
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thank you so much for staying up late. We really appreciate it. Have a great night, okay?
You too.
All right. Sonia, follow her on Twitter @BourbonFace. She's wonderful. News is next on 720 WGN.